An Osho Talk. The Discipline of Transcendence. Talks on the 42 Sutras of Buddha. Volume 4, Number 11.
The Buddha said, I consider the dignities of kings and lords as a particle of dust that floats in the sunbeam. I consider the treasure of precious metals and stones as bricks and pebbles. I consider the gaudy dress of silks and brocades as a worn-out rag. I consider this universe as small as the holila fruit. I consider the lake of Anavatapta as a drop of oil which one smears the feet. I consider the various methods of salvation taught by the Buddhas as a treasure created by the imagination. I consider the transcendental doctrine of Buddhism as a precious metal or a priceless fabric seen in a dream. I consider the teaching of Buddhas as a sky flower before my eyes. I consider nirvana as awakening from a daydream or nightmare. I consider the struggle between heterodox and orthodox as the antics of the six mythical dragons. I consider the doctrine of sameness as the absolute ground of reality.
The Buddha is the greatest anarchist of human history. He does not believe in any rule from the outside. To help you become free from the outside, he teaches you an inner rule, an inner discipline. Once you have learned the ways of the inner discipline, he is there ready to destroy that too. Because either you are ruled from the outside or from the inside, you are a slave. Freedom exists only when there is no rule. So the inner discipline is just a step to get out from the outer domination of the society, of the state, of the masses, civilization, culture, etc. Once you are free of the outer domination, then Buddha starts destroying your inner discipline too. That's why I call him the greatest anarchist ever. There have been people who have taught that no outside rules should exist, but Buddha is alone in teaching that even the inside rule is a form of slavery, a subtle slavery. No discipline is his discipline. And when a person is absolutely without any discipline, then there is beauty, because then there is freedom. Then one acts spontaneously, not according to any rule imposed by others or imposed by oneself. Then one simply acts out of nothingness. Then the response is total. Nothing is being held back. And there is no enforcement of any sort. There is no violence. There is tremendous grace. There is benediction. Because now the actor has completely disappeared, the doer is no more there. If you are trying to discipline yourself, the doer remains in a subtle way. If you are trying to discipline yourself, you remain schizophrenic. you remain divided. A part of you disciplines you, another part is being disciplined by you. So one part becomes the master and another part becomes the slave. Again there is division. Again there is duality. Again you are not one. And there is bound to be conflict between this duality. Because in reality you are one. And this is a fiction. Who is trying to rule whom? Who is there to be dominated by whom? There is only one existence inside, one being. To bring any sort of discipline means to divide that unity. And that division is misery. That division is hell. So first Buddha says there is no God. Because if there is a God and any belief in God, then man can never be free. Because then there is a dominator, a dictator. With a God in the world, there can be no democracy. Impossible. If God has created man, then of course he is the ultimate power. If he is omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient, then how freedom can exist? You are never left alone. He is everywhere. That's what the so-called religious people teach. They say, he is looking at you wherever you are. In the most private situation, also he is there, watching you constantly. His eyes follow you. This seems to be a very dangerous teaching. It means you don't have any freedom. It means you don't have any privacy. And God is like a universal peeping Tom. He is always there on the keyhole. You cannot escape from him. His very presence is destructive. His presence means man has no freedom. Nietzsche's declaration that God is dead and now man is free has a Buddhistic tone to it. That's what Buddha has said. God is not and there is freedom. Freedom means you are not created by anybody and you are not dominated by anybody and you are not manipulated by anybody. To Buddha, freedom is God. Try to understand it. It is difficult because Buddha uses such a terminology that it becomes very difficult to understand by childish minds. The childish mind can always understand there is God dominating you, looking after you, compassionate, kind, great, the father, the mother. These are childish ways to understand the truth. Buddha says there is no God and freedom is absolute. That absolute freedom is Buddha's God. Freedom is God. Freedom is divine. So first he takes away all outer beliefs. There is no need to believe in a God. The belief itself will become the barrier. Just the other night, a sannyasin came from England and she was very much nervous, trembling, shaking, and she said, I'm very much afraid because I cannot yet believe in you. I said, who expects you to believe in me? She was afraid because she thinks she doubts. The ordinary Religions have taught people that you become religious only when you believe. If you don't believe, you are irreligious. The West is completely unaware of a great religion that has existed in the East, which does not require any belief. In fact, it says belief is a barrier. A religion without belief is very difficult for a Christian or a Mohammedan or a Jew to conceive. It was even difficult for Hindus and Jainas to conceive. Buddha is a great revolution, a very radical outlook. He says all beliefs are dangerous. You should not believe. You should see. I told the sannyasin, don't be worried. Doubt is perfectly okay. Doubt is better than belief. Doubt can never hinder you. Doubt remains open. Belief is a closing of the mind. Then the aperture is closed. Then you don't look. In fact, a man who believes becomes afraid to look. Maybe the truth is against his belief, then what to do? He closes his eyes. With closed eyes, it is better to protect one's belief than with open eyes. Who knows? The truth may not coincide with your belief. The truth may shatter your belief. The truth may be against your belief. It may not be Christian, it may not be Hindu, it may not be Mohammedan. Then what you will do? So better remain with closed eyes. A man with belief becomes afraid. He does not seek and he does not inquire and he does not search. He never explores. He remains stuck with his belief. He holds his belief to his heart. This is out of fear. Religion is not out of fear. At least a real religion is not out of fear. At least it should not be out of fear. Real religion is fearlessness. Buddha says, with a God, how you can be fearless? The Jewish God says, I am very jealous. Don't worship any other God than me. I am very jealous. And if you worship any other God, I will destroy you. Now these words look very political and very stupid. And to put these words into the mouth of God Himself is sheer nonsense. God saying, I am very jealous, then God seems very human. Even below human, because there have existed human beings who are not jealous. A Buddha has existed who is not jealous. Buddha seems to be in a better state of consciousness than the Jewish God. Jealous? Prohibiting his followers not to worship anybody else because I am jealous and I will destroy you. What Jesus God says is simply unbelievable. He says, if you commit something against me for 10 generations, I will torture. Not only you, 10 generations of your children will be tortured. And if you worship me for 100 generations, the rewards will be coming to you. Now what type of God is this? And your child has not done anything. You committed some crime. You disobeyed the God. And your children for 10 generations will suffer. And for 100 generations, your children will get the reward if you have done something good. And something good means in Jeeva's terms, if you have obeyed the omnipotent God. If you disobey, it is sin. If you obey, it is virtue. there seems to be no real value. God may be saying something absurd, but if you obey, it is virtue. If you disobey, it is sin. And this threat that for 10 generations I will take revenge, and this bribery that for 100 generations I will avenge. Look what type of mind has worked out this concept of God. It cannot be very divine. It is not divine at all. It is in fact subhuman. Buddha says there is no God. Don't be afraid. To make man fearless, Buddha says there is no God. And to make man an explorer of truth, he says there is no need for any belief. Belief is not a requirement. It is an obstacle. Be open. Explore. Doubt. Think. Meditate. Experiment. And when a mind comes to experience truth without any belief, the mind itself becomes true. Because then there is a communion between truth and the mind. Be fearless. There is no need for anybody to dominate. Freedom is the very substratum. First he drops outer beliefs in God, in hell, in heaven, because your hell and heaven are just your projections. If you know about different hells and heavens, you will understand. The Tibetan's hell does not have fire in it. Because the Tibetan's hell has to have more cold, more icy. They know they suffer from cold. So the hell has no fire at all. Of course, the Hindus' hell has fire. They suffer from heat. The Hindus' concept of heaven is almost of an air-conditioned heaven. The sun is never hot, and cool breezes always blowing, and sedge trees, and flowers are of diamonds, and everything is cool. Of course, a hot country suffering for centuries from heat dreams. But things continue. They are your projections. There are as many hells in the world and as many heavens as there are climates. Because it will depend on the experience of your own climate. Fire in hell for a Tibetan will look almost a heavenly gift. No, fire has no existence in hell. It is absolutely cold. You will be frozen to death by coldness. Fire exists in heaven. There everything is warm. Now what these concepts sow? They sow your minds. They don't sow anything about heaven or hell. Man continues in his dreams, in his projections. If you die, you may be dying as far as your body is concerned, but your mind continues. In fact, the Buddhist approach is that the idea of heaven and hell has arisen because a man in his whole life projects, thinks about afterlife. And if he has been committing many crimes and sins, he becomes guilty. He feels that he is going to hell. He becomes very afraid. By the time he is dying, the fear arises. Now he trembles. Now there is no time left to put things right. Now he is going into hell. And he has an idea of hell, what hell is. So when a person dies, when he is free from the body, the projections become very real. He starts dreaming. So when a Hindu dies, certainly he dreams after death. Immediately he dreams either of heaven or hell. It depends. If he was a good man, virtuous, a worshipper, then of course he is very self-confident. When he dies, he knows that he is going to heaven. Immediately after death, the mind starts dreaming. The time between one death and another birth is used in dreaming. You live in a dream world. Exactly as you live in the night, what happens when your body relaxes and you go to sleep? You start dreaming. You forget your body in your sleep. Sleep is a tiny death, a very mini death. You forget your body. You don't remember your body at all. You become just your mind. As if the mind is no more burdened by the body and the reality of the body. The mind is freed. There is no pressure on the mind of bodily reality, of objective reality. Mind is freed. Suddenly you start dreaming. Of course, your dream is your dream. It has nothing to do with any reality whatsoever. Exactly happens when you die. And it happens in a bigger proportion. Once you die, all the pressure of the bodily reality and the objective reality disappears. The mind is free to dream. Now there is no burden. Even in sleep there is a burden. Even in sleep you are connected with the body, but in death you are disconnected completely. Now the mind is completely free. Like a balloon, it starts rising into its projections. So if you have lived a bad life, when I say if you have lived a bad life, I mean if you think your life has been bad. If you have been taught that this life is bad. For example, if a Jaina has been eating meat, he will suffer hell after his death, but not a Mohammedan. Not a Christian, not a non-vegetarian, who has never thought about it. He will not suffer hell. But a Jaina is bound to suffer hell. His idea, if he has eaten meat, will make him guilty. The guilt will be there. The guilt will project. And he knows what hell is. The hell will be projected. Between death and birth, there is a great dreaming time. And in that dream time you can live long. Because the dream time is absolutely different from your waking time. Sometimes have you observed it? You are just sitting in your chair and for a minute you fall asleep and you dream. And the dream is so long that it takes years in the dream time. Then suddenly you are awake and you look at the clock. And only 1 minute has passed. Now you are puzzled. How in 1 minute's dream you could see a projection of many years? You were a child, then you became young, and then you went to the college and the university and fell in love and were married. And just you were coming out of the church and the dream is broken. And there is such much expanse of many years. How it happened in a single minute? Dream time is different than actual time. It can happen in a single minute. So maybe between death and birth there is only few minutes, or few days at the most, or few hours, but they will look very long. You can dream infinite dreams. You can dream of hell, you can dream of heaven. But you continue. I have come across a beautiful anecdote sent to me by a few of my sannyasins. Once upon a time, there was a playboy named Siva. One day he suddenly died. His friends thought of inquiring if he has reached hell. Of course, naturally they thought that he must have reached hell. So they rang up in hell, the phone was picked up, and a voice boomed, "Hello, devil is speaking." "Hello, Mr. Devil, has Siva come to hell?" "No, try the other place. We have enough playboys here, and we don't need any more trouble," said the devil. So they rang up heaven, and a very, very holy voice said, "Hello, Virgin Mary is speaking." "Has Siva come to heaven?" "No, not yet," said Virgin Mary. "Try tomorrow." So they rang up again next day, and the same pure and holy and saintly voice said, "Hello, Virgin Mary is speaking." They again asked about Shiva, and she said, "No, not yet, try tomorrow." And her voice was as sweet as honey. Sweet in the beginning, sweet in the end, sweet throughout. So next day, they tried again, and a wonderful and sexy voice came, "Hello, Mary speaking." The friends looked at each other and said, "So he has reached." Your hell is your hell. Your heaven is your heaven. It is your projection. It is your personality projected in dream. These are not realities. Buddha is tremendously existential. He is the first religious man who has said that there are no heaven and no hell. It is just in the dreams of humanity that heaven and hell exist. If you have stopped dreaming while alive, then there is no heaven and no hell. In fact, there is no sin and no virtue. He is the greatest iconoclast, the idol breaker. He takes away everything from you. Because he knows, unless everything is taken away, the mind continues. Mind needs props. If all the props are taken away, the mind collapses. And in that collapse, reality arises in its true color, in its true tone. The reality is only when the mind is not. Mind is a distorting faculty. Now these are the last sutras of tremendous import. Each sentence is like a sword, and it cuts the roots of the mind. And when it comes to cutting the roots of the mind, Buddha excludes nobody, not even himself. That's his authenticity. It is not that he is against other philosophies. He is against philosophy as such. Against his own philosophy too. That's the authenticity of the master. It is very easy to be against others' philosophies. But to be against one's own philosophy means the man has no philosophy of his own. He is simply asserting a truth that philosophy is not the door to reality. He is against all methods, including his own. You will be surprised then why he uses methods. The methods are to be used only because of you, because you are not ready to take the jump. The jump is too big, and you take it in small doses. Hence, he has to invent methods. The same is true about me. I would like you to take the quantum jump without any methods, but you cannot take. Then the abyss is too big, and the fear possesses you. So I have to make small steps for you. Slowly, slowly I persuade you. The more you become ready, the more I push you into no method, into no mind, into no religion. The essential religion is no religion. And the greatest method is the no method. And to come to a state of no mind is to come to awareness. Buddha has to talk to many categories of people. But these sutras are for those disciples who have come of age, who have become mature. It happened once, I was chatting with Mullah Nasruddin, who is a rabid fisherman. I told him, I noticed, Nasruddin, that when you tell about the fish you caught, you vary the size of it for different listeners. Yes, he said, I never tell a man more than I think he will believe. And that's what Buddha is doing too. If you have come to him with a childish mind, he will give you some toys to play with. If you have come with a little better, a little more grown-up mind, a little more mature, he will not give you those toys. And if you are really mature to listen to truth, unafraid, then these sutras, the 2 days sutras are the last. They are meant only for very grown-up people. So listen them very attentively. It is said, once Jesus' disciples asked him, have you brought a message of peace to the world? He said, no. I don't bring peace, I bring a sword. A sword? And Christians have puzzled over it down the centuries, because it doesn't look right. Jesus is the messenger of peace. And he thinks, no, I have not brought peace to you, but a sword. And he says, I will teach you how to hate your mother and how to hate your father, and how to hate your wife and how to hate your husband and how to hate your children. And unless you are ready to hate your father and your mother, you cannot follow me. Now these words coming from Jesus, who says God is love, look very contradictory, very inconsistent. It is difficult to sort it out what he means. And it has been difficult for Christians. They avoid these sentences. But if you understand this sutra of Buddha, you will be able to understand Jesus too. He means by sword. Each master brings a sword in the world to cut the roots of the mind. And when he says, unless you hate your father and your mother and your family, you cannot follow me. What he is saying? He is saying, unless you drop that mind that has been given to you by your mother, by your father, by your family, unless you drop your past, unless you forget completely what the society has given to you, the idea of good and the idea of evil, unless you drop the whole conditioning that society has given to you, you cannot follow me. These sutras are like swords. They cut, and they cut totally. Buddha is very harsh because he has great compassion. He will not allow any loophole from where you can find your slavery again. So first drop all outer discipline and then drop the inner discipline too. In that undisciplined state is freedom, is nirvana, is moksha. And out of that freedom, whatsoever happens is virtue. Out of slavery, whatsoever happens is sin. The Buddha said, I consider the dignities of kings and lords as a particle of dust that floats in the sunbeam. He says, all political power, all power as such is stupid. Don't rush after it. Don't be ambitious. Because all ambition collects dust and dust only. If you are disillusioned by dust, you will not be able to know what truth is. A man obsessed with ambition is not capable of knowing truth at all. Eyes full of ambition never look what is. They only look what they want to look. Ambitious mind is the wrong mind. Non-ambitious mind is the right mind. To be non-ambitious, what does it mean? It means that you are not hankering for the future, that you are not hankering for the next moment, that you are not hoping for the next moment, that you have abandoned hope, that you live in this moment, that you don't have any future, that the present is all that is. A non-ambitious mind becomes still. And that stillness comes on its own accord, not that you still yourself. A non-ambitious mind is still. There is nowhere to go, nothing to hanker after. Then reality is available. For an ambitious mind, reality is not available because reality is available only in the present. And the ambitious mind is always somewhere else. Always somewhere else. The ambitious mind is never content. Discontentedness is its very base. Buddha says, for what you are desiring. Desiring for kingdoms? You want to become great kings and dignitaries? I consider the dignities of kings and lords as a particle of dust that floats in the sunbeam. Why he says that floats in the sunbeam? Have you seen sometimes a sunbeam enters from the roof? The whole room is dim and dark. Just one beam of sunray enters into the room. And then dust's floating, dust particles floating in it, you can see. They shine. They look like diamonds. They are ordinary dust. If the sunbeam is not there, you will not even see them. But in a sunbeam, they look like diamonds. They shine. They become radiant. Buddha is saying, when you project an ambition, when the sunbeam of the ambition is there, dust particles look very precious. They are not precious in themselves. And he should know he was born a king. Then he left those palaces. The day his ambition dropped, suddenly the sunbeam disappeared. and he saw only dust and dust. The night he left his palace and his kingdom and his wife and his newly born child. The charioteer took him out of the kingdom, not knowing where he is going, and the charioteer was not supposed to ask. But when Buddha came out of the chariot, and he told the charioteer, now you take it back, take my clothes, and please give your dirty clothes to me. He could not understand what he means. He said, what are you doing? Have you gone crazy? He was an old man of the age of Buddha's father. And he said, I have looked at you and I have loved you from your very childhood. What are you doing? I am just like your father. Tell me, what is your agony? Why you are leaving these beautiful palaces, this kingdom? You are the happiest man in the kingdom. Where are you going? And Buddha said, I look at those palaces. They are on fire. Everything is burning. The whole world is burning. And I want to move in a cool sedge. The charioteer, of course, was not able to understand what he is saying. He said, what are you talking about? I don't see any fire anywhere. What are you talking about? And Buddha said, you may not understand, but I have seen the fire. Everything is on fire. Everything is burning because everything is moving towards death. Just the day before, he had gone to the town, in his capital town, to inaugurate a youth festival. And on the road, he had come across a dead body. He had not seen a dead body up to that moment. He asked, what has happened to this man? The story is beautiful. The story is told in an Eastern way, in a mythological way. The story says the charioteer was prohibited by Buddha's father never to talk about death and never to answer such questions. Because the father was forewarned when the Buddha was born that ever if he comes to know about death, he will renounce the world. So the charioteer was not going to say anything. But the story says, one god, looking at this, entered into the charioteer's body. Seeing that the moment has come when Buddha is ready to renounce, and only through that renunciation he is going to realize the rare moment of existence has arrived. The gods helped. They forced the charioteer to say the truth. And the charioteer said, the man is dead, sir. And Buddha asked, is this going to happen to me too? When the charioteer had to say, because the guards were forcing him. So he said, yes, this is going to happen to you too, sir. And Buddha said, then return home. Then there is no point going to inaugurate the youth festival. I am no more young. Seeing death, I have become old. Seeing death, I have died. A great glimpse, a great insight happens. And Buddha said next day that the whole world is on fire. I have seen death. And when death is coming, then what is the point? I would like to find out something which is beyond death. I consider the dignities of kings and lords as a particle of dust that floats in the sunbeam. But we don't see death. Our ambition prevents us from seeing it. Even if death comes right in front of you, you will not be able to see it. Because your ambition will function like a barrier. It won't allow you. It is like a blindfold. I have heard rich manufacturer from New York suffered a nervous breakdown. "You must have a rest," advised his doctor. "Go to Florida. Lay around under the sun. Go swimming. You will be better in a month." The businessman followed the doctor's advice and went to Miami, got into his swimming shorts, and strolled the warm, sandy beach. Then the water was too much to resist and he went for a dip. But he had overestimated all the years he had gone without exercise. And before he realized it, he was over his depth and could not swim back. "Help, help," yelled the businessman. "Save me, I'm drowning." An alert lifeguard heard the cry, dove into the water and towed him to safety. The manufacturer's wife came running to the scene on the beach. "Irving, baby, are you all right? Speak to me." "I'm all right," wheezed Irving, dripping water. "But I have got to ask you something in private, please. Bend down." The worried wife stooped over. "Yes, Irving, what is it that you want to ask me? Tell me, how much do I tip for a thing like this?" He has faced death. But he asked his wife, "Tell me, how much do I tip for a thing like this?" Life is not a problem. Money is the problem. How much I have to tip. Even facing death, a man never realizes that the very existence of death makes a whole life meaningless. Money has no meaning when death is there. But the ambitious mind lives in a very different world. The sunbeam of his ambition makes dust particles shine like diamonds. Once the sunbeam disappears, once the ambition is not there, everything falls flat and you can see where you were going, what you were hankering for. If life is going to disappear, and it is going to disappear, it is going to move into the desert of death sooner or later, it is only a question of time. Then whatsoever you are hankering for is meaningless. Death will take everything away from you. Buddha says, "Seek something which death cannot destroy." I consider the treasure of precious metals and stones as bricks and pebbles. All your money, all your precious stones, all your bank balances, Buddha says, I consider as pebbles. You are children playing on the seashore of life, collecting pebbles. Colored, of course. Look beautiful, of course. But they are pebbles on the seashore, of no significance. And while you are collecting them, life is rushing out of your hands, slipping by. You are taking a great risk. This opportunity is not to be destroyed only in collecting pebbles. A man who took his two little girls to the amusement park noticed that Mulla Nasruddin kept riding the merry-go-round all afternoon. Once when the merry-go-round stopped, the Mulla rushed off, took a drink of water and headed back again. As he passed near the girls, their father said to him, "Mulla, you certainly do like to ride on the merry-go-round, don't you?" "No, I don't," Radhara hated absolutely, and I'm feeling very sick because of it. Said Nasruddin, but the fellow who owns this thing owes me 100 rupees, and taking it out in trade is the only way I will ever collect from him. Money seems to be the greatest obsession in the world. Money seems to be the greatest madness in the world. We go on selling our life and collecting pebbles. We call it money. One day, we simply disappear and the money is left here. And the life that you wasted in collecting that money could have been used in a more creative way. It could have become a song, a dance. It could have become a prayer, a meditation. It could have become a realization of truth, freedom. But you missed. Buddha says, I consider the gaudy dress of silks and brocades as a worn-out rag. All that you go on desiring seems foolish. There are people who live only to eat. There are people who live only to dress. There are people who go on playing with things. Good when you are a child, but it seems very few people ever become grown-ups. They grow old certainly, but very few people become grown-ups. To grow old is one thing, to become grown-up is quite another. A grown-up person is one who can see through things, what is a toy and what is not a toy. Small children playing, you laugh at them. But have you looked into your own life? Have you grown up at all? Maybe you have changed your toys. They were playing with toy cars and you are playing with real cars. But the play remains the same. There are people. Once I was a professor in university, and a professor used to live just in front of me. He had a car, but it was always sitting there. And he will clean it and wash it every day, religiously. I became puzzled by and by, because it never comes out of the porch. I inquired, he said, you see, the traffic is such, and the car is so beautiful. And it is risky to take it to the university. You know the students. Somebody may scratch it. Then why you have purchased this car? He said, I love it. Now think of loving a car. But there are people who love cars, who love houses. It is not very difficult to see what has happened to them. These are the people who cannot love a person. They can only love a thing. Because you can manipulate a thing, control a thing better than a person. A person is always dangerous. If you love a woman, it is always dangerous. If you love a man, it is always dangerous. Because a man or a woman is a freedom, intrinsic freedom. You cannot totally control. Man has tried in every way to create marriage and laws and this and that, and create respectability around it, and punishment and awards and everything, just to make one thing certain, that the woman is no more a freedom, that the man is no more a freedom. When a man is a husband, he is no more a person. And when a woman is a wife, she is no more a person. The freedom has been killed. Now, husband is a thing, and wife is a thing. It can be controlled more easily. If the wife does something, you can go to the courts. The magistrate will help you, the police will help you to force the wife back into her thinghood. People love things, and people are afraid of persons. Then people can go to absurd limits. Now, car has a utility. Certainly it has a utility. But to be in a romantic love with a car is absurd. And this is romance. Washing every day, half hour I will see him completely absorbed. And the car is never used. He goes to the university on the bike. And the car goes on, is sitting there. But he feels very happy the car is there. He looks at the car as if he is looking at his woman. Touches the car as if he is touching a human body. I have watched him. His eyes suddenly become aglow when he looks at his car. Something great happens around the car. It is absurd. Not only absurd, it is insane. But this is how things go on. I consider this universe as small as the Holila fruit. I consider the lake of Anavatapta as a drop of oil with which one smears the feet. And Buddha says, if you become aware, the whole universe looks very tiny, because awareness is bigger than the whole universe. Man is very tiny if you look at his body. Man is very foolish if you look at his mind. And man is tremendously vast if you look at his consciousness. Three things meet in man: the vast, the infinite, in his consciousness, in his awareness. That's what you become aware when you meditate. Boundaries recede and disappear. The body does not contain you. In fact, you contain the body. Ordinarily you think, I exist in the body. That is absolutely wrong. The body exists in you. You are vaster. You are bigger. Not only bigger than the body, you are bigger than this whole universe. It is awareness that holds all. But if you look at the body, you are very tiny. And then, if you go on getting identified with your body, a great desire arises to be big. That's what politics is. That's what the desire and ambition for money is. That's what you try when you use beautiful clothes to exhibit yourself. You try to hide the body, your tininess, your smallness. You try to make it look beautiful. You try to make it precious. It is said that once Mullah Nasruddin was in his Turkish bath, and there came Timurlane, the great murderer and the great emperor and the great conqueror. And only two persons were there, Mullah Nasruddin and Timurlane. And Timurlane, as was his habit, asked Mulla Nasruddin, "I have heard that you are a very wise man. How much you think is my cost, my price?" Of course, he must be hoping that he will say, "You are priceless, sir. The whole universe is nothing before you." But he looked at him, brooded over, and he said, 60 rupees. Temurlin was very angry. And he said, "What do you mean? 60 rupees? Even this towel I am wearing is more than 60 rupees." Nasruddin said, "That's why I said 60 rupees. I'm not counting you, you are nothing. Only this towel. I don't take any risk. That's why I say 60 rupees. If you are identified with the body, of course, your value is not much, cannot be much. How much value do you think you can get of your body if you go and sell it? If you ask the scientists, they say somewhere near 5 rupees, not even 60 rupees. Somewhere near 5 rupees. There is a certain amount of aluminium and iron and things like that, phosphorus in you. If they are all collected and sold in the market, they will be near about 5 rupees. And that's too because the cost of things has gone very high. And in the first place, nobody will be ready to purchase your body. Immediately, the moment you die, everybody is ready to dispose you of. Some way or other, just finish it now. It happened, it is said about the great Emperor Akbar, that he used to go to see a Sufi mystic Farid, and he used to touch his feet. Now, Akbar's court people became a little jealous. Akbar, the great emperor, touching the feet of a poor beggar. And they told one day to Akbar, "That doesn't look good. It is humiliating. You need not touch that beggar's feet. Your head is an emperor's head, and you put your head on his feet." Akbar said, "You do one thing. You bring a head of a dead man and try to sell it." When the emperor has said they had to try, wherever they went, people chased them out. They said, "Have you gone crazy? Get out from here. Your head is stinking. And who wants this head? Get out." They tried on all the shops in every market in Delhi. And from everywhere they were thrown out. They came back and they said, "Nobody is ready to purchase." Not only that, people even don't listen. They said, "Simply get out from here. Have you gone mad? What we will do with a human head?" Akbar said, "Then what do you think? My head is just a human head. One day, you will not get any price of it. So if I have put this useless head into the feet of Farid, why you think it is humiliating?" It is said that once a great Sufi mystic was caught by a few people who wanted to sell him in a slave market. He was a very young, healthy man, radiant. So they were very happy they are going to have good price. They took him. He said to them that, "I know you are going to sell me, but let me tell you one thing. If you listen to me, you can get the highest price possible. I know my price. You don't know. So Whenever you are ready to sell, just ask me, is it the right price? Just after a few hours, they came across a king, and the king said, the man looks good, I will purchase. I will give 5,000 rupees. It was too much in those old days. And they were ready, but the mystic said, wait, this is nothing. Let the right purchaser come and I will tell you. Don't be a fool. So they refused. A rich man came and he offered 10,000 rupees. Now they were ready. Not even they were going to ask, but the mystic said, wait, are you a fool? Have you not seen? The price is double now. Just wait. And then came another rich man and he offered 15,000 rupees. Buy now. Those people became aware that he is right. We are having a very precious man. And this continued the whole day. Many people offered, but the mystic was saying that wait. The last offer was for 50,000 rupees, but the mystic said wait. After that, people started going home. The market was deserting and came the last man. And he was carrying just a bundle of istra. And that was the last man. And those people said, now there seems to be no purchaser. And again, we will have to wait for 8 days. The next week, again, there will be market. The mystic said, wait, ask this man. They asked the man. And he said, I can give you this bundle of istra. I don't have anything else. And the mystic said, that is the right price. Sell it. This is exactly the right price. Now don't miss this opportunity. Those people started beating their head. They said, we have got a madman. 50,000 rupees we have lost. And now he says, this is the right price. But he is showing, he is indicating something. There is no price. The body is very tiny and very small. If you get identified with it, you are getting identified with a istra, a bundle of istra, or as Buddha says, a bag of skin full of filth. If you get identified with the mind, you have a little more freedom. But mind is foolish. Mind is stupid. Mind is mediocre. It does not know anything about truth. It simply goes on inferring about truth. Guessing. Mind is guesswork. Buddha says, if you get really to know yourself, then you are vast, infinite. Then you are God. I consider this universe as small as the holy la fruit. And I consider the lake of Anavatapta as a drop of oil with which one smears the feet. Buddha is saying, if you know man in his true reality, he is so vast that the biggest lake is just an oil drop on his feet. He is so vast that the whole universe is smaller than him. I consider the various methods of salvation taught by the Buddhas as a treasure created by the imagination. This is the source. It cuts everything from the roots. Now he says, I consider the various methods of salvation taught by the Buddhas as a treasure created by the imagination. All methods are created by the mind, so they cannot lead you beyond the mind. That which is created by the mind cannot lead you beyond it. To go beyond it, you will have to leave all that is created by the mind. Methods are also created by mind. Yoga, tantra, yantra, mantra, all methods are mind creations, imagination. Beautiful imagination, sweet dreams, golden dreams. And of course they are created by Buddhas to bring you out of your body. Mind is used. So few techniques there are to bring you out of the identification with the body. Then, to bring you to the very boundary of the mind, there are other methods which bring you to the very brink where mind ends. Then you have to jump out of the mind, of course, by jumping out of all methods. I consider the various methods of salvation taught by the Buddha as a treasure created by the imagination. I consider the transcendental doctrine of Buddhism as a precious metal, a priceless fabric seen in a dream. Buddha says, even what I am saying to you, maybe it is very precious, but precious metal are precious stones seen in a dream. That's what I say always to you, the truth cannot be uttered. The moment you utter it, it becomes a lie. Truth cannot be said. The moment you say it, it is almost a part of a dream now. No more truth. The Zen Buddhists say, Buddha never was born. Never walked on earth, never taught a single teaching, never initiated anybody to be his sannyasins, and still they go and worship Buddha. Looks absurd. Rinzai used to say that. One skeptical philosopher came. And he heard Rinzai saying that Buddha was never born. And just behind Rinzai was a great statue of Buddha. The thinker waited. And Rinzai said that he never taught anything. In fact, he never existed, so how he can teach? And then when the sermon was over, he went to the statue, touched the feet and offered few flowers. The skeptical thinker said, wait, now there is a limit to everything. This is going to be too much. You say this man never walked on the earth. You say he never taught. You say in fact that he was never there. And now whom feet you are touching? Whose feet you are touching? And to whom these flowers are offered? And Rinzai laughed and he said, I am offering these flowers to this man because he taught, and still he said, I have not taught you anything. He was born and yet he said, that which is born is beyond birth and death. He walked down the earth, but still deep inside he remained immovable, never walked. The wheel moved, the hub remained in its place, center. Buddha's teaching is tremendously contradictory. First he teaches you, do this, do that, and then he suddenly says, drop all. Now the boundary of the mind has come. Now drop this last dream too. I consider the teaching of Buddhas as a sky flower before my eyes. Have you watched sometimes sitting by the shore on a beach, look into the sky and you will see flowers moving in the sky. Now scientists say they are ions. Or if you ask Wilhelm Reich, he says they are particles of argon energy. If you ask the eye specialists, they say there is nothing. Just the movement inside your eye nerves creates the fallacy of something in the sky. You can press your eye by a finger and then you can see those flowers more. These are called sky flowers. They exist not, but you can see them. And if you move your eyes, they will come down and they will go up like yo-yo. You can play with them. But they are not. They are not existential. Buddha says, I consider the teaching of Buddhas as a sky flower before my eyes. All teaching is meaningless. Truth cannot be taught. It can only be caught. There is no way to teach it. By teaching, you can transfer words, doctrines, beliefs. Truth is never transferred that way. But being with a Buddha, you can catch it. It is infectious. Hence the value of satsanga, being with a Buddha, being with a master, being with one who has become enlightened. What does it mean to become enlightened? It simply means, says Buddha, I consider nirvana as awakening from a daydream or nightmare. He says you are living in a dream, the dream of ambition, desire, 1001 types of greed, anger, lust, passion. You live in a dream. Nirvana, enlightenment, is nothing but coming out of the dream. Just becoming awake. Nothing occult in it. Nothing esoteric in it. Buddha has no esoterics in his teachings. He is very simple. He said, this is all. The man who lives in the world, the worldly man, the sansaric man, is under a dream. That's all. And the Buddha is one who has come out of the dream. The difference is not in their consciousness. The difference is only that the worldly man has something more than the Buddha. Buddha has only awareness. The worldly man has awareness plus dreams. And because of those dreams, the awareness becomes clouded. As if the sun is clouded and you cannot see. Clouds disappear and the sun is there. But as far as the inner light is concerned, there is no difference between a Buddha and an ignorant man. They are made of the same stuff. I consider the struggle between heterodox and orthodox as the antics of 6 mythical dragons. And Buddha says it is all nonsense. The traditional and the anti-traditional and the orthodox and the heterodox and the theist and the atheist and 1001 types of philosophies and systems and fighting with each other, arguing, proving, disproving. He says it is just a game, mind game, mythological. It has no significance. Don't be too much entangled with theories and doctrines. They are part of the dream. Get out of the dreaming state. Become more aware. I consider the doctrine of sameness as the absolute ground of reality. This is his ultimate assertion. Meditate over it. I consider the doctrine of sameness as the absolute ground of reality. Buddha says things are not different, they are same. They only look different. They only appear different. The tree there and the rock and you and the animals and the stars are not different. At the innermost core, reality is one and same. Substance is one and same. There are no distinctions. Distinctions are dreams. Physicists call that one reality electricity, or energy. Materialists, Marxists, communists call that reality matter. Idealists call that reality mind. Yogis call that reality consciousness. Buddha calls that reality nothingness. Now this word nothingness is very important. Nothingness means no thingness. No thing is. All things are just forms, dreams. We are different only in forms, and forms are just dreams. It is as if out of gold you can make many sorts of ornaments. Those forms, different ornaments, are just dreams, because the gold is the reality. Behind all the forms is gold. Behind all the forms is one reality. Buddha says that sameness is the absolute ground of reality. If you go in, you leave the form. First you leave the form of the body. Have you observed it? People who are close to me and meditating, they come again and again to that insight. And these sayings can be understood only if you have certain insights of your own. Otherwise, it is impossible to understand them. When you are meditating, many times it happens you forget your form, your body. You don't know who you are and how you look. You forget your face. In fact, in deep meditation, you completely become oblivious of your body. When you close your eyes, you are formless. Your mind has also form. You are a Hindu, Christian, Mohammedan, Jaina, Buddhist, then you have a form of the mind. You think in terms of being a Christian. You have a certain identity. Dogma defines you. But if you go still deeper, mind also disappears. Then you are no more a Christian. At the deepest core, you are neither a body nor a mind. Then what you are? Buddha says nothingness. No thingness. Now you are not a thing. Now you are universal. Now you are not confined in any idea. You are infinite. You are that which has always been there and will remain always. You are eternal. Then there is no birth to you and there is no death to you. That you are like the sky. Clouds come and go and the sky remains untouched by them. Millions of times clouds have come and gone and the sky has remained pure and virgin. It has not been corrupted or polluted by them. You are the inner sky. And when all forms disappear, the inner and the outer also disappear because they are also forms. Then there is nothing inner and nothing outer. Oneness, sameness. Buddha does not call it God, because to call it God, you may start thinking again of form. But that's exactly what the word God means or should mean. God is that sameness that exists in all. God means existence, isness. The tree is, the rock is, the cloud is, The man is, forms are different, but isness is the same. As far as isness is concerned, tree and you are the same. The form is different. The tree is green and you are not green. And the tree has flowers and you don't have any flowers. And the bird can fly into the sky and you cannot fly. But these are differences of the forms. But isness is the same. To look into that isness is what meditation is all about. And to come to realize that isness is nirvana. This is the last message, the last sutra of this sutra of 42 chapters. This is the 42nd sutra. Buddha's ultimate message. I don't think you will be able to understand it right now. Intellectually, of course, you can understand it. But the real understanding has to be existential. That will come only if you follow the path of inner discipline to the point where you can drop it. If you follow the path of meditation to the point where even meditation becomes a hindrance and you drop it. It is like you move on a staircase from one floor to another. But when you have reached to the other floor, you get out of the staircase. You don't cling to it. All methods are staircases. Are in Buddha's terminology, all methods are like boats. You cross the river, then you leave the boat and you forget all about it. Methods have to be used and then dropped. It has to be remembered from the very beginning, because there is every possibility you may become too much attached to the method. You may become too much attached that the method becomes a clinging. You start possessing it and it starts possessing you. Then the medicine has become a disease. It happens. You are ill, you take a medicine. Then illness goes, but you cannot leave the medicine now. You have become accustomed to the medicine, to the drug. When the illness has gone, throw the medicine immediately. Meditation is a medicine. Because you are ill, you have to use it. When the wellness has come, then drop it immediately. All devices have to be dropped one day, and all scriptures have to be dropped one day. This is the greatness of Buddha, that he says that even his teachings, his methods, has to be dropped. When Zarathustra was saying goodbye to his disciples, the last thing that he said to his disciples has to be remembered. Keep it in your heart. This is what Buddha is saying in the last sutra. Said Zarathustra to his disciples, now I am going and this is my last message. Beware of Zarathustra. And he left. Beware of Zarathustra. Beware of the master. Because you can fall in love too much. You can become too much attached. The real master is one who helps you to fall in love and then helps you to stand on your own so that you can lead the master. A real master never becomes a crutch for you. Never. Before he sees that you are clinging too much, he starts getting out of your life. Because the ultimate goal is freedom. Freedom from all crutches. Freedom from all props. Freedom from every discipline, doctrine, method. Freedom from all. That's the goal. Always remember that goal. Remembering that goal will help you not to go astray. A small story, and I will finish this discourse. It is a Hasid story, the three prisoners. After the death of Rabbi Uri of Esterlisk, who was called the Seraph, one of the Hasidim came to Rabbi Bunam and wanted to become his disciple. Rabbi Bunam asked, "What was your teacher's way of instructing you to serve?" "His way," said the Hasid, "was to plant humility in our hearts. That was why everyone who came to him, whether he was a nobleman or a scholar, had first to fill two large buckets at the well in the marketplace, or to do some other hard and mental labor in the street." Rabbi Bunam said, "I shall tell you a story. Three men, two of them wise and one foolish, were once put in a dungeon black as night, and every day food and eating utensils were lowered down to them. The darkness and the misery of the imprisonment had deprived the fool of his last bit of sense, so that he no longer knew how to use the utensils. He could not see. One of his companions showed him, but the next day he had forgotten again. And so his wise companion had to teach him continually. But the third prisoner sat in silence and did not bother about the fool. Once the second prisoner asked him why he never offered his help. 'Look,' said the other, 'you take infinite trouble, and yet you never reach the goal, because every day destroys your work. But I, sitting here, am not just sitting. I am trying to bore a hole in the wall so that the light and sun can enter, and all three of us can see everything.'" Now, there are two types of masters in the world. The first type I call the teacher. He teaches you things, disciplines, virtue, character, but next day you forget. Again he teaches you the same, and next day you forget again. The second I call the master. He does not teach you virtue. He does not teach you character. He does not teach you ordinary humility, humbleness, poverty. No. He bores a hole into your being so that light can penetrate and you can see yourself. He tries to make you aware, full of light. That is the real master. In the East we call him Sadguru, the right master. Teachers are many. Sadgurus are very few, far in between. Remember this distinction. If you are with a teacher, you may become a good man, but you cannot become enlightened. And your goodness will always remain on a volcano. It can erupt any moment. If you are with a teacher, he will teach you outward things. How to discipline yourself, how to be good, how to be a servant, how to serve people, how to be non-violent, how to be loving, kind, compassionate. He will teach you 1,001 things. If you come to a master, he teaches only one thing. That is how to become aware, how to bore a hole into your being so light can enter into your imprisonment. And in that light, everything starts happening on its own accord. And when things happen on their own accord, they have a beauty to them, then there is a great benediction. Enough for today.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.